This is a recording of Dave L. from Visalia, California, taped at the monthly NA speaker meeting in Visalia, California, on Saturday, June 29, 1991. In observance with our 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all NA speakers.
And very glad he's here is David Lady. Not, oh, David L., yes. 90 Day Dave, how's that?
Welcome to Wally World. My name is Dave, and I'm a drug addict. And like I said, welcome to Wally World. I think I found out so far, for me, there's like, we got two rides in this thing. What I have found out, I got the merry-go-round of insanity, and I got the emotional roller coaster. You know, and what I found out is that I ride that merry-go-round of insanity a whole lot. And the silly thing about the stupid ride is it keeps telling me I'm on the emotional roller coaster. And all of a sudden I stop and come to and realize I've just been going in circles doing the same thing, you know, and feeling all crazy. I am scared to death. The old disease is just, I got a committee running off right now that, I mean... Actually, I've got it down to about two or three voices, but they've learned ventriloquism. And, what I've learned how to do is I've learned how to separate, to some extent, my disease from the real me. And I call my disease the rat. And what I've found out is when I bring the rat out into the light, it loses a lot of power. So you guys will help me out and, like, say hi to the rat. Hey, I'm not afraid anymore. I got into recovery, made my first stab at it, I guess, forced, thrown in, whatever. I had an intervention by Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon, and I worked at the NBC affiliate and nodded off during the Tonight Show. And didn't run some commercials and proceeded to get fired. And through that was the last mistake I had made, that I had promised that if I make another one, I'll get help. And damn, they held me to it. I went into recovery on January 23rd of 1986, and my sobriety date is January 19th, 1987. It took me a while. Not as long as others. But, you know, and I didn't catch on as quick as others either. It was, you know, when I first came here, I didn't want to have a problem. I wanted to be the only guy that God put on the planet Earth to use heroin and not become addicted. And, you know, what I've since come to find out is that it wasn't the drug. It's not heroin, it's not alcohol, it's not cocaine. Because I, actually, if I get real honest, like, I was every one of those. You know, I had my years where, like, well, this year I'll be a crankster gangster. And, I don't know about you guys, man, but I get weird on that stuff. I took up a whole page, on my four step on sexual issues just on my crank years, you know? You know you're getting bad when you're going down the road going, nice dog. And kind of has a wiggle, you know? You know, and then the paranoia, I would get so paranoid that besides thinking people were following me, I got afraid people thought I was following them. I'd be going down the road, and you know, like you're behind a car for a while, and they just happen to be making the turn I'm going to make, and I'd go, God damn, they're going to think I'm following them. You know, and so I'd go this whole different route, you know, and it, just so they wouldn't. Another wonderful thing I found about this disease, too, is it has given me the ability to read minds. You know, it tells me I know exactly what you're thinking. The only thing is, you don't know exactly what you're thinking. You know, I had my marijuana and beer therapy. I tried that for a while. That didn't work. I even tried to get hypnotized one time, and that was great. You know, I have no idea if I was really hypnotized. I remember laying there on this chair, and they got this music going, and this lady's telling me all these wonderful things, and you don't want to use heroin anymore because you are drug free. And I kept thinking, I'm not really hypnotized. I could open my eyes any minute here if I wanted to. And then I'd go, but I don't want to break her heart. You know, I mean, she thinks she's really doing something. And I ended up, I didn't use for 2 days. You know, and so on the third day I thought, if I'm really hypnotized, and if I go score, I won't shoot up. Well, when I came home with the cheeks hanging down and everything, and got screamed and yelled at again, like always happened, it was amazing. I used to wonder, like, how people knew I was getting loaded, you know. And my ex-wife, I would be getting out of the car and shut the door, and we had this little kitchen window where you could see out onto the street and the driveway. And as soon as I'd shut the door, she'd be in that window yelling at me, "You did it again!" And I'm going, "I haven't even got in the house. What? How can you?" You know. And I got some pictures of me when I was using. My cheeks are clear down here, you know, and my eyes drooped. Actually, my top lid like started somewhere down here, you know. And then I wondered how anybody could tell. And I think maybe like every time I tried to eat a meal and projectile vomited, that kind of gave it away too. We were sitting there, and the one day I'd gotten away with it. I had gotten away with it. Or at least I thought I had. And she makes this dinner and everything, and we go into the living room to eat. We're going to watch this thing on TV. See, eating food always gave me away. I didn't eat. It was like, that was one of the, I did when I was a kid. You kind of stir it around and make a little hole in the middle of it so it looks like you've eaten something. And maybe get a little bit on the edge of your mouth. And so I'm eating this stuff. I had a couple of bites, and I'm sitting there and I go, uh-oh, just relax. And we eat a little, I took another bite, and, well, how is it? It's, and here it comes. I tried to blame it on marijuana, you know. That was one of those, you know, whenever you're busted for, like, using heroin or crank or whatever, you go, no, I just had a couple of beers, you know. It's okay, I just had a couple. You know, I'm one of those that I didn't really have a choice. When the first time I ever added a chemical, it was all over. I smoked my first joint at the age of 13. I took my first drug at the age of 13. It was my first day of high school. We were walking to school, and I smoked a joint with a guy, and within 3 months I was eating Reds, and got busted for barbiturate, under the influence of barbiturates in history class. Teacher knew I had a problem when I had to shut one eye to read. You know, I'd like this, and actually no words came out. What came out was like a lot of spit, you know, and something like Columbus, you know, and it never got better. It progressively got worse. You know, they say that if drugs or alcohol have ever caused a problem in your life and you continue to use them, you've got a problem. I never could catch on to that. It was always everybody else and everything else. And if things would just go right, you know, if things would just fall into my lap, things would fall into my lap and I'd stand up. You know, I didn't want it. I didn't want to work. I didn't want to go to school. My goal in life was to have a couch and a 25-inch TV and all the dope I could use. You know, and if I could have found a way to, like, hook up some way to go to the bathroom without getting up, I'd have been happy as a clam. You know, and I worked real hard at achieving that. But what got real hard was trying to not let people know that I was like that. You know, it's real hard when the old lady comes home and says, well, did you get the job yet? And the back of your hair is sticking up like this where you've been on the couch. I'm overqualified. And, you know, that's just how it went all the time. And, you know, then I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous, and the first time I went was at the Parr Center in Porterville. And I was staying at a halfway house that had just started up. Well, actually, I went to one place. It was called the Safe House. And the very next day, everybody ran from that and created a new one. You know? Everybody that was originally in that place is still clean today. And if you'd have seen us then, you wouldn't have believed it. I mean, I think more than half of us went back. All of us but one went back out again at one time or another. You know, I don't know if Rick T was in there with me. him and I, they made a path for us. You know, that's all we did. We would come in, stay a week, and then I'd throw my mattress in the back of the truck. Well, time to go. Well, what happened? You got loaded. And what ended up happening is then Rick came over to live with me over here in Visalia with me and my parents and my wife and my two kids and my sister and her kid, and we were all practicing. And the idea behind them letting Rick move in was that Rick would help me stay clean. Ooh, I got me a running partner. And Rick would do some things I hadn't done yet. At least he said he did. And right around that time was the only time I had ever really gotten 90 days. I had taken some 90-day chips. I never had gotten 90 days before. I mean, you know, the old lady thinks, you know, you're on the 29th day and you just used 2 days before. You know, you got to come home with a 30-day chip. And Rick and I went to this place over in Porterville, and it was an old abandoned trailer. And we scored some dope from this guy, and we're sitting in there cooking it up. And I brought out my 90-day chip, and I said, look, I've been clean 90 days. And he goes, you have? Why are you using? I don't know. You know, and he goes, yeah, I know. I said, but if I had 90 days, I wouldn't get loaded. I'm like, fuck you, you know? So I gave him the chip. And Rick and I proceeded to go down to L.A. to go see an Angels game. And on the way down 65 there, we're going down the road. We're gouged to the hilt. And here's a guy from NA who broke down on the side of the road. So far as we know, he's still broke down on the side of the road. Rick ducked, I turned my head, and we punched it. So I have a real hard time. The only thing I keep hearing now is the whole time I'm sitting over there while people are reading, John keeps turning around going, just be honest. And I go, thanks, John, no pressure, huh? Because what I found out is like, my truth is, all I got is my truth. All I got is how I remember it, how I saw it, and how I see it now. And it's changed. I mean, there's like three different ways. There's like how the other person saw it, how I saw it, and then how it really happened. You know? And sometimes it takes me a while to get to how it really happened. And I went on my last run on my, I think it was my 30th birthday, 31st birthday, October 3rd, 1986. And what I did is, I don't know how to describe it to anybody. I mean, I don't have to describe it. I can give you a few words and everybody will nod because I think they've felt it. There's nothing inside. It hurts all the time. Wondering how I got here, how can I get out of here, and knowing that there's no way out. And thinking, see what I always thought, I had made up my mind and I knew that where I was going, they were going to find me in an alley somewhere. I was going to be in some alley or some shooting gallery. You know, either the thing stuck in my arm or right next to me. And during this time too, I got very paranoid. I've been reading about people who had died, and I'd read this thing on Lenny Bruce and stuff, and he died, and a couple of other people, I think it was like maybe Elvis or something like that, they didn't have their pants on when they died. And like, that scared the hell out of me. I thought, you know, find me anywhere you want, but God, let me have my pants on. You know? Because there for a long time, that's what I would do. I mean, the bathroom was where I lived. I would go to people's houses and go, ooh, I could stay here for days. You know, and I would sit down like on the toilet and figure out the reach from the sink, how much I would have to get up. And I don't know about you guys, but, you know, there for a while, at the end, like going to the bathroom was a luxury. To actually, doing French and I were talking about this the other day, you know. Yeah, but bowel movement is like an act of God, you know. And like right before you're going to fix, you know, hurry up and pee because you ain't going again for another 24 hours, probably, or 12 hours. And so drink lots of water and try to pee and then fix and then get all that hot flush and everything else and get real thirsty and need to drink more, and I'd start drinking water and everything else. And then I'd have to pee. But I couldn't. So I'd go in the bathroom, and I'd have to sit and, like, push my elbow against my stomach and lean, and it'd go, squirt. And I go, damn, you know. And I got, this is, you know, I was thinking about the mentality, the stuff that I make up and how I think or how I thought out there, and sometimes not much different. But like some of the weird things you have to do, you know, we were talking about like why it was so hard to have a bowel movement. Well, you've been living on Snickers bars. I mean, that's all I ate. I Snickers and Squirt, you know? The drink. Because I'll tell you what, it didn't come out like squirt. It came out just like the whole bar, you know. And it usually took a long time. And when you didn't have, you had a long period in between each one, things were very susceptible to being hurt, and those peanuts did not do any good. And what I got scared of is that's when I was going to die. I got scared of when I was doing that, and I finally going to be able to go to the bathroom, that's when I was going to go out. You know? And so, like, I would start timing. I'd go in and sit down and go, you got 5 minutes. You ain't done. You get the hell out of here. You know, some of the other weird stuff, like when you go for the methadone and they give you your dose, and then you got to have them rinse the cup out so you can get every little bit. Yeah. Or when you fix, now I've learned this now since I've been to school and everything, the blood moving through your body moves real fast, real high rate of speed. And you ever seen a syringe? You can squirt one of them suckers clear across the room if you want to. So I fix, let everything go, pull the needle out, a little bit of blood comes down, I got to get that last bit of dope. That could have been the part that's keeping me from getting high. You know, what is that? You know, we had a guy that would sit there and fight with you. We had this one guy, you always got one of them in the group, there's always a cotton chaser. And this guy's like, come on, man, give me a cotton. And this guy, how do I know that what's in that cotton isn't the exact amount that I need to get loaded? You know, this whole gram that I'm doing could be just enough, but that one little bit I leave in the cotton, that's how much I needed to get high. And you're going to take it. It made perfect sense to me. Perfect sense. So what I did is I became one of those guys. I became everything that I said I would never become. I hated those cotton chasers and became a cotton chaser. I became the guy that hung out at the Connections house to see what would fall on the floor. I'd start coming to meetings and I'd hear Tony say that, wait till you start running errands for the Connection. No way. When I went back out, I was running errands for the Connection. I was stealing meat out of my family's freezer and taking it to them. You know, give me a half a bag for a tri-tip. And still trying to look cool. Still thinking I was cool. And slowly but surely what happened is then I started coming back around here. I'd show up at a meeting every once in a while. Didn't look too hot. And I'd sit over in the corner, away by myself. One time they were silly enough to call on me. And it was something about being able to look at yourself in the mirror was the topic. And I knew they made that topic just for me. That I had this old army coat. I had that all pulled up. Oh, another thing too, because about the bathing. So I didn't bathe. Because when you bathe, you sober up. So I wouldn't take a shower or anything because then my high wouldn't last as long. The only time I finally would shower is when my hair would start hurting so bad. You know, you have to wear a cap or something like that, and it's like sticking in these strings and stuff, and you pull it off, and you can almost like hear the hair break, you know, and stink. You know, I wear the same long sleeve or long john top. And then wonder why them bitches wouldn't talk to me. I lost my train of thought. I started hanging out here at the meetings and stuff, and then finally what happened is I called Nancy, my friend Nancy in Dinuba. Actually, she lived in New London at the time. That screwed things up, too. Finally got a connection in New London, and she lived there. And I couldn't go into that town because I was afraid she'd catch me. And, you know, at the halfway house I lived at, or stayed at, Nancy was like the house mother. You know, we had to do our little chores after breakfast, and she was the one to make sure we'd get it all done. And so we'd have breakfast, and Rick and I and Alan, we'd run into the bedroom and hide because the women weren't allowed on our side. You know, fuck it, let her do it. So we all go in there, and we shut the door, and we're standing in there like laughing like a bunch of little kids. Nancy's not going to catch us. About that time on the window. Get the fuck in there and do your work. And there she is standing in the bedroom window, you know. And I called her up, and I said, I think I had enough. And she said, well, come on back, you know, we're... Everybody misses you and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, yeah, you're running this stuff out, so I'll come back, you know. Nobody misses nobody. Nobody even knows I've been gone. And so what I did is on the last time I took anything, well, no, it wasn't the last time. It was the last Saturday I took anything. It had all quit. Everything had quit. It was the last day. I didn't know it, but the body did, God did, whatever. And I think one of the biggest thing that bothered me the most was the look on the guy's face. I was staying with this guy I'd known since like the third grade. And I went out, I had my truck packed. I knew I was going to leave. I just didn't know when. And I was literally, I thought I was trying to con the guy. You know, make it sound like we're going to have a good time. And what I was doing was I was begging this guy, buy a six pack. Just, you know, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. And I was helping him collect firewood. It wasn't so much the begging that bothered me. It was this look he gave me. And as soon as we got back with the... He finally went and bought the six-pack. And I drank the first beer, and it didn't taste any good. And it just kind of like gurgled around in there. And then I just opened up the second one and got about halfway... through it, some guy showed up with a whole bunch of cocaine and laid this big, long, fat line out. And I did it. And I just had a flash. It hit and went. Just that quick. And I was halfway through that second beer and I set it down on the counter and I said, no, it's time for me to go. And I left. Came over here to Visalia, found Grandma's codeine cough syrup. I drank half of it on Sunday and the other half on Monday. I'm going to meetings. In fact, Nancy had promised I'll go with you to every meeting. I'll make sure I'll give you somebody to go with. The second day she calls up and goes, I can't do it anymore. And, you know, thank God. I needed to learn how to do it on my own. And I finished that codeine cough syrup. And that was the last thing I had to take. You know, and that was on the 18th of January, 1987. And, you know, the neat thing about it now is, you guys probably all heard, I just got back from Utah. Today I just spent a week in Salt Lake City at the University of Utah learning about this stuff. Here's people with all these letters and stuff behind their names, and it's not, they're all they have is like different words for what we use here in the meetings. You know, the big $10 words. But the neat thing about it is I set some goals when I went. But I wasn't going to gamble because I had to go through Nevada. Because I gamble the way I drink and use drugs. Actually, it's not the gambling I like. I just like to give people my money, you know, especially if I think I'm going to get something out of it. And went over there, and this is what's so neat to me is I did it by myself. I went alone. And actually had a pretty good trip. There was a couple of times I thought, oh, man, I wish I wouldn't have come. But it was all me. It was all me. By the time I got there, I'd been in the car for 2 days, or a day and a half, with rock and roll on the stereo for 1,000 miles. I got out of the car, I felt like I'd been on a road trip. You know, I hadn't showered or anything, and my hair sticking out, and you know, I was tired and dirty and felt great. I loved it. And when I walked up to the campus, actually who had shown up was the 16-year-old kid. And I started looking. You know, I would do what the 16-year-old kid does. What'd you guys do when you were 16? Ooh, she's pretty. And I caught myself doing that. You know, the first day I was there. And I thought, you know, you just spend a lot of money. And if you spend this whole week chasing women and don't get anything done, you're going to feel like shit. So I resigned myself to that and decided, you know, 16-year-old kids here, I'm going to let him do some things after school. You know, like I'll go out to the movies. We'll go to an NA meeting. We'll go to the video arcade. And that's what I did. And I was real proud of myself, man. And it's on the third day, and I'm walking back from class. Class has just gotten over. It's 4:30 in the afternoon, and I'm walking back. I had about a half a mile walk from where the classes were to the dorms. And I'm patting myself on the back. You've done a good job, Dave. Man, you're really growing up. You know? And all of a sudden, I hear this scream. A lot of screams. And I look up, and here comes 100 16 to 18-year-old cheerleaders running right at me. The kids going, all right, yay! The adults going, oh, shit, we're in trouble now. I wonder what the law is for statutory rape in a Mormon state. And all I did was I looked up at God and I said, oh, man, you got a sense of humor. And they were real cute and neat to watch and everything for the first few hours. And, I decided to look at it that way, like God has given me a gift. You know, he's going to give me a menu to look at. Doesn't mean I have to order from it. And, God makes you strong by putting you through tests and all this stuff. And when I was ready to go to bed that night and those little girls were still screaming and yelling, I went into Jason. I was ready to get the hockey mask out and the machete. By Thursday afternoon, I hated them. I hated every one of them. And I thought if another one looked at me and went, I was going to snatch her teeth out. Just, you know. Almost over yet? Okay, now we're going to get to the honesty part. When I first got into the program, the main thing I remember is I thought if I can just get past 90 days, if I can just get past 90 days, I know I can do 90. And I got to 90 days. I used to go to this meeting up in Kingsburg every Friday. And I hit my 91st day on a Friday at Kingsburg. And I thought that was great. And everybody up there knew me from when I had been going to meetings there and stuff. And, man, I was getting pats on the back. And so I go back the next week, and I got 98 days. And I'm telling them, yay, you know, and I get pats on the back. Well, somewhere around 140 days when I'm sharing this stuff, finally, somebody pulls me aside after the meeting and goes, Dave, we don't give a fuck anymore. Knock it off, man. You're wearing it out. But what I thought at that time is when I got to 90 days, I thought I had to use the only mentality I knew how to use, which was if I've done 90, I can do another 90. And that's what I did. I started over. And when I did the other 90, I got a 6-month chip. And if I do another 90, I'll get a 9-month chip. See, I knew I could do 90. I didn't know if I could do 6 months. I didn't know if I could do 9 months, but I knew I could do 90 days. And which is kind of different from... anybody, you guys notice the difference between the people and according to the drug they use? See, I know those cocaine addicts got a real hard time with that one day at a time. They got to go by seconds because the numbers are bigger. You know? I used to let her go to that CA meeting that Jack had, and that other meeting, whatever, you know. And watch all the people's feet underneath the tables. I'm not going to explain to you what I was doing down underneath the table. But watch all their feet going, man, just going like hell, you know. And they all, their little area where they sat at the table was sparkling. They'd take a sip of coffee and then clean it until they're ready to take their next drink, you know. And then they'd fight over who was going to make the coffee, you know. That's honest, yeah. And then you got the heroin addicts who think they're tougher and, you know, they like to use, I'm a heroin addict, like I got something harder to do or harder to kick than anybody else. Bunch of shit. But it's for me, what I noticed is it's our own way of, like, it was my way. I don't know how anybody else is using it. But it's our own way of, like, that's our defense when we come in, you know. That's how we got to be different. That's how we got to be somewhat, you know, this is my wall. This is what I'm like. This is who I am. And see, I didn't think I belonged when I first got here because I didn't have tattoos and I didn't smoke non-filtered cigarettes. And I thought that's what you had to be. And, you know, the cocaine addict has the deal. You know, they wear the Mr. T starter kits and, and then you got the PCP addict that he's not really quite sure why he's there. It just seems like the thing to do at the time, I guess. Nowhere else to be. See, I used to sit in this meeting and this guy would talk about that his marijuana was his problem. And I would sit there and think, well, fuck, if that's the only problem I had, I wouldn't need these stupid meetings. And what I came to find out is, like, you know, it ain't the drug. If this guy's got a problem with marijuana, he's got a problem. It's fucking up his life. You know, no different than what the heroin did to mine, no different than what the alcohol did to mine, no different than what any of the other drugs did to mine. You know, it's this thing, this common denominator, it seems like, that I've noticed around here, this thing called pain. And, see, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm going through pain, yours ain't shit compared to mine. Yours ain't nothing. You could come up to me and tell me that your mother just passed away, but if I stub my toe, you're not hurting as bad as I am. I mean, that's just how it is. And actually, the thing is, see, I can't understand anybody else's pain. I don't know how to understand it. I don't know how to deal with it. I have a reference point. Like, if you tell me your mother passed away, then what I have is I have a reference. I can remember something that would maybe, like, be comparable to that. And that's the best I can do. You know? I don't know how you feel, what you're going through, what you're thinking. I probably really want to know what you're thinking. And, Pain to me is like what has been the greatest motivator. I'm losing my thought here. Everybody's walking around and my disease just went off on me. Everybody's walking around because I'm not interesting. Sit down. See, what happened is pain. Pain's what finally made me quit using drugs, and pain's what finally made me want to start making changes. You know, one of the things I want to bring up tonight and kind of use as a thing. See, I'm going through a deal now in my life. I really want to get off of this because I hate talking about when I used. I mean, I know I did. I know I used. You know, I didn't use as much as others. I used more than others. It doesn't matter what the tradition says, is I had a desire to quit. And that's all that matters. You know, and I can sit here and tell war stories just like anybody else. I can make a few up. I can pick some out that I've heard here, and I'll put my name in them. You know? But what I want to talk about is recovery. And, you know, I walked around here for 3.5 years talking the best recovery I knew how, was like, which was like a lot of bullshit. But to me, at the time, it was true. It was my truth at that moment. It was what I thought. I thought I was doing the right thing. Some things were changing, but what I was doing was riding the merry-go-round. You know? I think I was doing things different, but it's like, got this saying that, like, I just found new ways to play the old game. You know, the ride would stop and I'd go, here I am again. And I'd think I was on this big emotional roller coaster, and at the time, I had no emotions. I mean, I had them, but I didn't know what they were. I didn't know what they felt like. All I would feel was like this explosion going off inside, and then a lot of thoughts. And I couldn't tell the difference between a thought and a feeling. When I walked in here, I was dead from the chin to the waist. I couldn't feel anything. I didn't know what I felt like was just this hollow thing walking around with this big giant head on it that had 900,000 plans, thoughts, blueprints, maps. It just, you know, anything and everything was just going all the time, every second. You know, and in the beginning, all it was telling me to get loaded. Get loaded, get loaded, get loaded. That's all it did, you know. And I learned how to not act on that. And what it did is then it started telling me, go show them your chips. Go show the connection your chips. Show them how good you're doing. And I quit acting on that. And all of a sudden it dawned on me one day that, like, just because I have a thought doesn't mean I have to do it. See, I used to think I was what I thought. What I think is who I am. And if that's true, I'd be this big vagina walking around. You know? Probably be a few of you in here going, is he thinking about me? And what I found out is that, you know, I'm not what I think. Because if I was what I thought, I'd have gotten some real trouble with those cheerleaders. And I'm what I do. I'm how I act. And, you know, that's a big change in me. That's a big difference. And one of the things that I've really gotten in touch with in this recovery, and one of the things that they brought up at this school I was going to and everything, and one of the things I'm going to be dealing with here in about 2 weeks is kids. Like I said, at 3.5 years clean, the pain was enough that I finally decided to work the steps. But if I had attempted a bunch of times, I attempted my first 60 days, but if anybody notices that on the fourth step it says fearless and thorough, and I don't know about you, but I couldn't be very fearless and thorough at 60 days. And actually what I did is I wrote out a first step. I just wrote down all the nasty, rotten things I had done, and instead of it, I was supposed to take a moral inventory. And writing down the nasty stuff isn't immoral. You know, I would see the word moral and kept thinking it was saying immoral. And but in about 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to be getting custody of my son. And one of the things that on the last day there at the school, after I quit hating those cheerleaders, is what I started wondering was how many of them were probably getting brutalized at home. You know? There was a lot of them there, and the odds are, like, quite a bit of them. Besides the physical and emotional, you know, the sexual. And I've made a commitment to myself that when I found out I was going to be getting custody of my son, that, like, there's a lot of things I need to learn how to do. See, my only parenting skill is what I was taught as a kid by my parents. And everybody sitting here today can tell you about how they were screwed up before they ever took the drug. And nobody here can say about that their parents were 100% great. You know, and that's nothing against my parents. My parents did what was done to them. But I think the idea behind Narcotics Anonymous and behind recovery is we're here to stop the cycle. You know, to minimize what damage we've already done. And so far, like, working the steps has been the only way I've found to be able to do that. It's gotten me in touch with why I do the things I do. And there are some things that I'm so blocked off on that the steps aren't working. I got some therapy last year, and if I can find somebody around here in Visalia, I intend to continue. I want to start doing that family of origin. I want to go back and find out why. You know, I'm scared to death to even talk about it and think about it. But some of the counseling that I went through last year is fantastic. You know, and part of the counseling was, besides what she taught me and everything, is she integrated my 12-step program in with it. And what I want to talk to you guys about the kids is if you stopped using and you got children, you're probably still treating them the way you were treated. You know, and if that's not motivation enough to start working some steps to see why. If you don't want to work the steps, they got parenting classes. At least just go and get maybe another point of view. See, we got this fantastic word, and this is just my opinion. You guys go ahead and use whatever you want. This is all my opinion. We got this fantastic word called spanking. It's a nice word for hitting. And I don't know about you, but if somebody three times the size of me and outweighed me by 100 pounds came up and spanked me, I wouldn't like it. I would think a lot different about that person. You know, and if you think about, I don't know about you guys, but how I was raised and how I see it, like I can open up a dog training book and get the same answers. You know, if he gives you any shit, you whap him across the face. You know, you tell him to sit, shut up, be quiet, don't create a noise. When you're at the family get-togethers or whatever, you go over and you sit over there. If you tell them you feel, they tell you no, you don't. You know, if you wonder why, you know, the dope took away a lot of my coping skills, but I didn't have any before I took any. Before I ever took my first drug. I'd been told I didn't feel the way I felt for a lot of years. You know, and then you take, then I use drugs that makes that so at least I know how I'm going to feel. I can regulate it. I know how I feel. And then you take them away again. And we're in our 30s, late 20s, teenagers. You know? And then we wonder why we don't feel. Or how can we feel funny? Or how can we keep doing all these crazy, stupid things? Geez, I'm 30 years old. I should know better. Who taught you? Nobody taught me. See, my ideas on sex were taught to me by other 13-year-old medicated boys who happened to have older brothers that were medicated, who read dirty books. That was my concept of of sex. That's what I learned. And I learned it like, see, this is one of the, now the, this is great thinking for me. This is my thinking. I want to go out with this girl. I want to go out with her. I want to have sex with her. And I'll do everything I can that night to have sex with her. I'll work, I'll spend money, I'll give her dope, I'll give her booze, or whatever it takes. And as soon as she goes to bed with me, she's a whore. It never dawned on me, what's that make me? You know, it's like, see, what I found out is like, whore is a judgment call. You know, nobody's sitting, if I turn around and called somebody a whore, that would no more make them a whore than if I turn around and called them a chair. I mean, they're not a chair just because I said it. They might be doing something that I wouldn't do, but that's all. How do I know they're not okay with it? And what I found out, too, is probably that girl was just as scared and wanted to be accepted as much as I did. And I came into recovery with that belief system. I'm 30 years old and still thinking how I was taught as a 13-year-old kid. You know? If you remember about the children, and if you choose to not do anything to change about it, then yeah, you better get into service work. Because you're sure as hell going to need a big NA for our kids. Because if that's where we went to, where do you think they're going? And actually what we can do really is minimize, you know, who's really going to maybe get the chance is our grandchildren. If the earth lasts that long. You know, it's, and it was relationships itself, women, is what finally got me to work the steps. You know, my sponsor had me write down a list of what I thought women, what women found attractive in men. And I made a list of like about 15 or 20 things. You know, I went around to 3 or 4 female friends and I asked them to make that list of what they found attractive in men. I got back over 60, 70 things from their list, and I had 15 to 20 on mine. I only matched 3. And the third one was a gimme, because we both had the same word in the sentence. You know, my idea, my perception of what it is, of what's really going on is way off. It always has been. See, and then through this counseling and through this work in the steps, what I did is I found out my issue behind women. Anybody hear of Bob Earl? But he said this thing that like women all come in looking for the husband and the men are all here looking for mommy. And I thought, well, that's the biggest sissy I ever heard. And as I'm writing this 4th step out, I'm about halfway through writing out this stuff on the effects and my patterns and how I keep doing things, and all of a sudden this light clicked on. Actually, it wasn't a light. It was a movie. I saw myself at 13 years old. And I acted the same way with my mom. Didn't have sex with her. But I acted the same way. And I'm halfway through this and I go, oh, Jesus, I want my mommy. And when I found out all this stuff and was able to look at my patterns and everything, it slowed the tapes down long enough that when I got real lonely and everything and felt like I needed to have a woman, I needed to have a companion, it slowed it down enough that I would get this picture in my head of a female. There's no head. It's just like the shoulders, like sitting in a rocking chair. And what I wanted to do was just cuddle up in that. That's what I was looking for. And I found that, in, you know, by doing the four steps. You, if I have a nice-looking female on my arm, you don't look at me. This is my belief. You know, what I do is I got a nice-looking woman on my arm. This is my mirror. This is what you're supposed to look at. Don't look at me. Now you wonder why maybe I get a little protective of her. You wonder why I get afraid somebody might take it or she might go. Because if she goes, then that means it just feeds it. You once again have told me that I'm not worth anything. I wasn't good enough. And see, and I have this image to project to the males, you know. If I got this fine looking babe, this is a neat thing that happened up in Fresno. When I got in touch with all of that, and I went after doing the steps and everything, and I had to go to this person, the last person I was in a relationship with, and do a ninth step and tell her all those things. And see, I got this big macho thing or whatever that I think. They're like, see, also if she leaves, then that means I wasn't good enough in bed. You know, and you guys are going to find that out, and you're all going to have some sort of men's meeting somewhere where I'm not invited and laugh at me. I told her this. And what she told me was, is one of the men in the fellowship that she's friends with, because she had never gone out with anybody in that fellowship, they had decided she was gay. So this whole time I'm walking around with this woman, showing off to the men, thinking I'm a stud, and they're all going, look at them faggots over there. So once again, this image I try to project, and what people really see are two different things. You know, then and then I would see these people after she told me that, and I thought, oh man, you know, and I would, then the disease starts reading minds again. The guy's wondering who my boyfriend is. He's watching me to see if I'm looking at him. You know? And I was just enough scared of those people up there that I wish that wasn't. It would have been, really been neat to a couple of them go. Which, I noticed that when I was up there in Utah, I was doing it. Every once in a while, I'd like make eye contact. I got so clumsy when I was up there. It's like maybe using my brain and then the rest of my body doesn't work. Twice that I can remember. I probably did it other times, just wasn't able to catch on to it. I would see a nice looking lady, you know, and I see this one, I'm walking, and how are you? And you know, you hit that, you trip on the crack in the sidewalk and do this, and then you instantly turn around and look back like, who pushed you? You know, and then this thing says, well, you've blown it. Yeah, she figures she got some sort of physical disease there, you know. And this other one, I'm at dinner and I'm eating by myself, and she's across the way, and then I look over at her and she makes eye contact. How you doing? And then I just happened to reach up and I felt this string of cheese hanging off my chin. I said, Dave, maybe it's time you go to a movie. Also, what I found out about me in the fourth step is that I'm a scared little boy. That's all it is. I am so afraid. Fear has run my life. It is, you know, and it got so good at it that it, you know, it would say things and tell me things that I didn't even. It would go by so fast that I didn't even realize I was being told. Next thing I know is I'm reacting to all this craziness and everything. And so with this lady again, We had some things going on, and we needed to talk. I was learning how to set boundaries. You know, what happened was, like, Doc told me this one time, and I never could understand it until I actually did it. Finally did the four step. Tells me what's acceptable, what's unacceptable, and what's not negotiable in my life. What I will allow, what I'm willing to talk about, and the things that I'm just not willing to. It's set in concrete. And I was setting these boundaries down, and we're sitting there, and I said, this is what I need, and this is what I have to have happen, you know. And she said, I think that's very valid, and I'll honor that. Not like that, but it sounds like that. And next thing I know is I'm getting angry. And I started trying to pick a fight. And I caught myself, and I went, what are you doing? She agreed. And I stopped, and I just, you know, never mind, just, okay, you know, we were going to the movies. So get on the bike, you know, let's go. And we start driving down Blackstone, and I get about 3 blocks, and all of a sudden I get this overwhelming urge to apologize. Take it all back. I didn't mean it. All these boundaries I've just set down don't mean anything. I was stupid to even think that. And I go, what the hell? What's going on here? And I just kept riding, you know, and I got to the, we got to the movie theater, and it stopped, and all of a sudden it dawned on me. It's what I call reacting to an always. This is what always happens. I try to tell somebody no. They tell me it's not right. I don't feel that way. I'm sorry. I take it all back. I did it, went through the feelings, went through everything, and nobody was playing. I didn't even need a partner, and I went through all of it. That's an always. See, and now what I've learned is that what's really happening and what I see and perceive is not the same thing. And the only thing I've been able to learn how to do so far is to realize that. The neat thing is I finally, like, I'm starting to feel my body, realizing that, like, when my heart starts beating fast and my stomach starts knotting up and everything, doesn't mean I'm about to fix. It means, like, something's not right. That's how it was before I fixed. My heart would start beating fast, my stomach would knot up, and I'd get gas so bad. You know, it was great. Nobody, the cotton guy stayed away from me. He's like, oh boy, don't fix next to Dave, you know. And I went through that for 3.5 years in recovery and never once put the connection together. I'm going through the same process as fixing. I'm going through something, going through the same process, doing something that hurts me. And I'm reacting the same way. Well, how come I can't make the connection? You know? And I finally was able to. Doesn't mean I always stop. I'd like to say I recognize it and stop every time. You know, there's still enough of that in me that, like, yeah, I'll pay the consequences. And those are, like, some of the promises. You know, I don't know, like, exactly which one, but I know when I first got here, is like, I would hear people talking about feeling, and I'd go, I want to do that. And then I'd get a bad one, and I'd go, oh, no, I don't want to. I thought you guys meant feeling meant good all the time. And that's what I'm talking about, the emotional roller coaster. So, you know, everybody talks about the emotional roller coaster, and to tell you the truth, you know, I had one meaning for it in the beginning, and, like, since I've, like, got in touch with this stuff, is like that emotional roller coaster. I want to ride it. You better believe it. I want to ride the emotions. I want to feel them. I want to go through them. It's like tonight when there was this mix-up over who was going to, if there was a speaker or whatever, and I got, what really happened is I got afraid. And what the little kid told me was that they don't want me. And the disease starts telling me, shut up, you big baby, blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I heard that saying it, and I go, no, you know what? Lay here and feel it. Just lay here and go through it. See what it feels like. Listen to what your body tells you. Listen to what your head tells you. I mean, here's a good time to do it. And then Pam called and said everything was all straightened out and ruined the whole thing. I didn't get to do the exercise. No, I did. It was real neat. What I did is I got to hear the little kid who thought once again, you know, things have been pulled away. It was something, you know, I really wanted to do this. I really wanted to. From the time I saw Rick T standing up here and talking, you know, he shared here a couple of years ago. Because like I shared earlier, when Rick and I were going out and using and everything, if he'd have told me like one of us would be standing up here, no way. You know, and I remember sitting out here and then listening to Rick talking, and it was everything I could do to not cry. Because I remember we'd sit there and go, fuck, we're going to get loaded again. You know? About out of time? I want to try something. First of all, this is what I've learned about the steps. This is my interpretation, how I picked it up, how I, you know, I have to put things into how I can understand. The guy up there at the school was talking about arrogant and everything else and grandiose and what I have to, like, translate into, oh, yeah, fucking asshole. You know? And, you know, what the first step tells me is that, first step tells me is my ass is kicked and I don't know what's going on. You know, because you see, the first part of the first step was no problem. It's that second part that I always forget. And what it does is it says lives. It doesn't say part of my life. It doesn't say this one area of my life. It doesn't say every area but women. It doesn't say every area but eating. You know, it says lives. And what I do is when I do that one, then I become teachable. And the second step, you know, it just says that there's something better than me or greater than me, but here's the secret part of it. That can restore me to sanity. You know, I tried to make everything on this planet Earth my higher power. And not one of them could restore me to sanity. And the third one just says I've made a decision that I'm willing to follow through and to believe in a God of my choice. Whatever I want to call it. It could be the brick wall, it could be anything. And what I found out is 4 through 10 keep me open to that. Or open me up to it. And, you know, the meditating and stuff, as far as I go now, is like I sit there and I try to, like, listen to what my body's telling me. And to me, see, that's what, when it talks about spiritual, my concept, spiritual means your spirit. It's in me. It doesn't mean I'm chasing this thing off out up here or anything. I don't have to. It's right here. Always has been. That's why I hurt so bad when I used. When I was born, God gave me a gift of morals and values that nobody taught me. You know, that little voice says, maybe we better not do that. And this one goes, fuck it, quiet. God told me. And what I had to learn how to do is get in touch with it. And by working those steps is how I've been able to do that. And I don't always hear it. I don't always feel it. Sometimes this thing gets, especially if I'm afraid. If the fear happens too quick that I can react to or do anything about, I'll follow this thing blindly. I'll do whatever it tells me to do, you bet. Uh-huh. See, God gave me this gift. Nobody else did. And to me, that's what the whole 12 steps are for, to get in touch with. You know, and I know there's other areas I gotta have to go through them again. You know, it's amazing. I mean, the only thing that would really bum me out about it is once I found these things that were like unacceptable and not negotiable, then I had to find something else to do. It's like I would sit there and go, well, I can't do that. I had to find a new way to do things. Like hurting people was really starting to hurt me now. Knowing I'm doing something to somebody for my own personal gain was really starting to bug me now. And like this lady in Fresno told me, she goes, oh, poor Dave, you become too aware. Because I'd snivel about it. There's nothing to do. I can't, you know, because all the things I'd been doing up to that point, you know. And one of the neat things, you know, and by getting in touch with this stuff about women and everything, I learned all the stuff like why I have a hard time with men. Because all these things that I think a real man is supposed to do, and if you see, because what I always thought, these guys would talk about going to do this and go to do that, and it didn't feel right to me. And if I'd say no, then they'd go, what are you, sissy? And what that really meant to me was, I'm not a human. I'm less than. There's something wrong with me. You've just reinforced what's been told to me my whole life. And now it's okay, you know. It's like, no, it just don't feel good. I don't want to do it. You know, and one of the neat things that it was is like, I mean, sorry for my crudeness. I don't know any other way to put it, but I found out like just because it got hard, I don't got to use it. I thought I did. And I thought if you turned it down, there was something wrong with you. Well, I don't know about you guys, but there was times I had sex I didn't want to. I thought it was my job. I thought that's what you're supposed to do. That's what them kids on the corner told me. And there was nothing wrong with them. You know? Anyway, I'd like to try something. Everybody can kind of like get together close enough where you can hold hands with the guy next to you. Come on, look at the walls and the defense is coming up. Whoa. Just so you can hold hands with the guy next to you. Just wanted to see if you'd do it. No. Trust me. Close your eyes. I'll get my issue later. Close your eyes. Just take a big, deep breath and let it out with all the bad, icky things. And just start thinking about the person who's been like the most important person in your life through your sobriety. That one person you've looked up to. And when you feel it, try to give it to the person next to you. Now think about the person who just walked through your life or has just been a part of your life, just came through and had a big impact. Now open your eyes and look at the person next to you. I do that all the time. It helps me to get grateful. Because without everybody in here, I wouldn't be here today. I got two people that are like very important in my life. That all I have to do is just think about them for a minute and like really all the problems kind of go away. And then what I try to do is go share it with somebody. I mean, I don't share it like I was thinking about these two friends of mine and I feel really good and guess what they did. It's just I want to share like some of me feeling good. And I think that's supposed to be the whole idea here. You know, we share the bad and we share the good. And like the real neat thing about it is like, now I'm going to get my issue. How many people have been a part of my life since I've been here? Raise your hands. And you're still showing up. Before I came here, only two would have raised their hands, and then I would have had to call them up to let them know to raise their hands. Now, one of them wouldn't have showed, the other one couldn't have. Well, thanks for letting me share tonight. I love you.